Hey, Deserve listeners, I thought I would do some additional spring cleaning and answer your patron emails over the past number of months. Patron Billy from Texas, he wrote in and asked, I'm a 26-year-old male, and I have had a history of going down some dark roads when it comes to pornography. I watched some stuff that I have a hard time forgiving myself for. I basically broke my moral code, and it made me feel evil. I don't think at my core I'm an evil person, but I can't seem to forgive myself for what I did. I lost all my friends and try to avoid everyone because I'm so ashamed of what I did. No one got hurt in the video, and it wasn't illegal, but I don't want to say more than that. I've never told anyone my secrets, and I feel very, very alone. How should one go about forgiving themselves if they feel they've done something wrong and they can't move past it, and it's causing great distress? And they just feel like an awful human being who deserves nothing good to happen to them. End of email. Okay, so if I just answer the question as it's presented, forgiveness is a process. It's a journey. It's an exploration. And therapy can sometimes be necessary. So I don't have much more to say than that, unless I knew what you were talking about. But the premise of your question, I'm a little confused about. You say that you watched some pornography that was not harmful to anyone and was not illegal, but you basically broke your moral code and it makes you feel evil. And you've lost all your friends and you avoid everyone, even though they don't know that you watched it. Because you say, I haven't told anyone my secrets and I feel very alone. You say, I lost all my friends. I from the sound of it, it sounds like you lost all your friends because you avoided all of them. It sounds like no one knew you watched this video. So if no one was harmed in the video and it's not illegal, then what are we talking about here? There's a possibility that you watch something that is ethically and morally fine, but you've internalized an anti-sex or anti-pornography paradigm that is shaming you unfairly. And you can't forgive yourself because you're struggling with the premise of the accusation internally anyway. You know, for example, there's a possibility that in your situation, I don't know if this is you, but someone in your shoes could tell me this, and what they watched was gay videos, right? Gay pornography. And morally speaking, because of some oppressive, ridiculous notion that being gay is wrong, that you somehow are breaking a moral. You sinned because you watched pornography that involved gay people. And you hate yourself and you're yelling at yourself and shaming yourself and you can't forgive yourself and you have impulses to watch it again, or there's a part of you that liked watching it, or I don't know, because there's a part of you that is gay or you're bisexual. And thus, internally, you have a conflict between internalized homophobia and your true self. So, I don't know. It's really hard to figure out what's going on. But if you're purely asking, how do I forgive myself, regardless of what it's for, then yeah, it's a journey that you probably need to do in therapy, particularly given the way you're talking about it. There's also a possibility that a schema of defectiveness is involved, that just baseline, regardless of anything that you've done, you always consider yourself to be defective and wrong because of the way you were treated growing up, and has nothing to do with what you looked at and has everything to do with just your schema. And obviously that would be for therapy as well. All right, this next email is from patron AJ from Dallas. She says, how much compartmentalization is healthy? I often have people say to me things like, wow, I don't know how you've been able to be so successful despite all the things that you've been through. I always think to myself, well, probably because I have rigorous methods of compartmentalization. So I want to know how much compartmentalization is healthy. These days, I feel like, well, I'm in my mid-40s and it's worked for me well for me so far, so why would I change things now? But I secretly fear that one day it'll all blow up in my face. Have you ever heard of this kind of blow-up happen with a patient that was in their 30s or 40s? End of email. So compartmentalization is a defense, but defenses aren't always negative. There are healthy defenses and unhealthy defenses. There are healthy versions of a defense and an unhealthy version of a defense. For example, denial is neither healthy or unhealthy. You have to evaluate the particular situation. To go into denial of your alcoholism, for example, is probably unhealthy because it denies you the opportunity to see reality enough so that you can make changes in your life. But if your child died last night and today you can't deal with it because emotionally it's too hard to deal with, so you go into complete denial, and you might even believe in a semi-delusional way that your child is still alive. Is that healthy or unhealthy? Well, that actually could be healthy. It gives the body a chance to slowly adjust to the idea. So it just depends. And compartmentalization is the same. Compartmentalization could be very unhealthy or it could be very healthy. The difference is the defense causing problems? So in your situation, from your description, it sounds like it's not. Now, we'd have to do a full assessment to really know, but if you evaluate your life as going fairly well, then the defense is working really well. The other way to look at it is it might not be compartmentalization. It might just be that you have enough attachment security. You know, I don't know what you went through, but let's say you were very much abused growing up and you don't think about it very often. You've always not thought about it very much. But there's a possibility that a good portion of your soul has already processed a lot of the emotions, has already accepted what happened and felt the feelings sufficiently enough that it's no longer needed to be thought about. And whenever you go there in your mind, memory-wise or whatever, it does trigger some bad feelings. But overall, you're not walking around like a wounded individual who has triggers on trauma. So the thing I would ask myself if I were in your position is, do I have a lot of significant triggers in my life? The other thing is let's say you do have a big trigger, but it is easy to avoid. Like maybe violence is a trigger, and so you just don't watch violent movies and you steer clear of violent people and violent situations. And so even though you're quote-unquote compartmentalizing, maybe even avoiding that element of recovery from the trauma, you just don't run into it very often. And by the time you die, you'll never run into it. And you live a fine life. You live happy. So that's one question. The other question is to ask, like, are you happy? Is your life going well? Do you have any dysfunctions? Is there any element of your life where your psychology is significantly getting in the way? If not, then your defense is, at least seemingly, based on your evaluation at the time, at this moment, seem to be working well. But I'd have to assess you, obviously. Kind of sounds like that's the situation. Then you worry, well, maybe it'll blow up. And yeah, it's possible, but it doesn't usually happen the way that people have in their minds. Like somehow you'll just have like a psychotic break, or you'll just have a complete meltdown and everything will fall apart. That can happen, of course, but it doesn't usually happen. I suspect the only thing that would happen to you is, let's say that you just go through a period of time relationally or at work or something where it's particularly stressful and you're particularly triggered that in a way that is similar to what traumas you went through as a child. And you start to have some depression, you start to have more anxiety, you start to withdraw some more. And you could have avoided that level of depression and withdrawal if you had done some work and had not compartmentalized so much prior to that moment. So that's not like a blow up in your face, it's just like an increase in symptoms. That would be much more likely than just having a complete meltdown psychologically. But like I said, there's a chance that nothing will ever happen and that your system totally works. The other possibility is that you weren't actually traumatized in the clinical sense. Many people go through harrowing, horrible, horrific experiences that we would call traumatic, but it didn't affect the individual's psychology as such that they're forever affected by it, or at least affected by it until they enter into a recovery program. So you might have been through something really awful and just had enough resources and enough protective factors in your life to avoid the ongoing syndromes thereof. All right, this next email is from annual patron Rose from Chicago. She says, what is your take on the casual use of the words like insomnia or binge? Someone close to me recently said it is offensive to use the term binge watching because it should only be used for those struggling or recovering from an eating disorder. So just jam me in here. Yeah, the term binge traditionally was used in the context of an eating disorder, but even more so traditionally in the context of binge drinking or binging on cocaine over a weekend. So typically the word binge in the past, in the distant past, I would say more so than now, was used for a clinical context and to describe something that's really quite difficult in that someone was suffering quite a bit. And so to say binge watching, it is trying to metaphorically call upon addiction. I think it's more of an addiction oriented annotation rather than a binging and purging and eating disorders. So I think when the term binge watching came out, I don't know the history of this development of the phrase, but I have a feeling that they were thinking like you have a night of binge drinking or you have a night of binge watching and you just consume an entire TV show in an entire night or a weekend or something. So that's, I think, the connotation there. And is that problematic? Yeah, obviously it could be, and it's hard to know. You'd have to ask people who suffer from addiction or an eating disorder to know, because sometimes I will find that white people will say, hey, don't culturally appropriate that part of Japanese culture. And I'll think to myself as a Japanese American that it doesn't really bother me when people do that. And so you can't just assume that because a word came from a stigmatized condition and now we're using it in a more casual sense, you can't assume that the people who suffer from those conditions are offended by that usage. It's sort of weird. It's like, to me, it is a matter of that question. Is the target offended by it? And also, you're going to find outliers in every population group. You know, of the people who have suffered from an addiction or an eating disorder, there's going to be some percentage of people that will be offended by anything, you know? So at what percentage, to me, and this is just how I gauge it, would I consider the term binging to be problematic? Or maybe it's the sort of thing where it's like, well, even if one person out of a million gets bothered by the use of the word, maybe I just shouldn't use it because of that. Maybe there's another word I can use. And that's usually kind of the tack that I take. For example, in a recent episode a few months ago, we aired a rerun, and we were talking about people who try to manipulate others, like salespeople who are con artists, who are, you know, they pull their shenanigans to try to trick you into buying a car or something. And I use the word shyster, and that's always the word that I heard growing up and really well into my adulthood. I had no idea that that had a anti-Semitic history, and people told me about it, and so I don't use that word anymore. We reran the episode, and I didn't think to listen to the episode and re-listen to make sure that things like that aren't in the episode. So, and at least I don't even know if that's the truth. I just know that one person reached out to me and said that that word is anti-Semitic, and I plan on looking into it further just to make sure. But that's, when people say that, it's usually not false, right? So along those lines, like, sometimes you just don't know. And you're thinking you're using a word that's fine and on the up and up, and then someone tells you, you're like, oh. And that's all it is. You know, I didn't think that shyster had anything to do with Jewish people. Like, I just thought it was just a word that people use to describe someone that was trying to pull one over on you, you know? Now, other terms are more obvious, you know, like the phrases Indian giving, that kind of stuff, it should raise red flags for racism and the origin of it. So the word binge, is it wrong to have the term? Is it offensive? Is it hurtful? And I think that's a much better word to use. You know, the word offensive, I'm offended, has just lost all meaning in our society. And I recommend that people return to the word hurt. But it's more vulnerable to use that word, which is, I think, why people avoid it. But is it hurtful? Does the phrase binge watching, does it hurt people who suffer from an addiction or an eating disorder? Does it hurt their feelings? Does it minimize their condition? Does it make them feel bad? Does it make it seem like people are making light of their suffering? And if true, then yeah, we should definitely use a different term, right? I wish that people just thought more about their language, you know, it's particularly a store owner. There's many examples of this, and I don't have them in front of me, but I've seen many of stores or podcasts or TV shows just without seemingly any market research or any kind of research into the terms they're using. They name their business this thing, and it's just a really obviously a. I mean, there are worse examples. Let me actually look some up. Yeah, so I just looked up some. I didn't go very far into the internet, but here are some. And these are offensive terms, so trigger warning. These are racist terms. So there's a coffee shop, Beaner's Coffee. And then another thing here, Audi has a car that translated from German into white power. So there was a model of Audi that was called White Power. And you had another business here that does siding, I think, or they help with log homes that are made out of logs. And the company is called Permachink. So yeah, the thing that you just have to say to yourself is, how about you just do a little Google search on the words that you're considering calling your business before you open the business? You know, like insomnia cookies. There are so many different other phrases you could use that get across what you're trying to get across. You know, a cookie store that is open late. You know, I'm not a creative person in that way, so I don't know. But I'm guessing that if you whiteboard a bunch of different brainstormed ideas, there's got to be others in the mix that aren't potentially harmful to people who suffer from a legitimate horrific disorder like insomnia, you know? Anyway, going on with the email, I got to thinking, there is even a salon by my house called Wax Asylum. Are these all problematic terms we will look back on in the future and think, what were we thinking being so insensitive? Or is it normalizing having a problem with, like sloop food insanity, etc.? Well, the second part of your question, I would say no. I don't think that these terms are normalizing the things. I don't think that the terms help with normalizing mental issues. I don't think that that happens, at least the ones that we've discussed so far. But yeah, I think in the future, there's a good chance that a large portion of our language today, we will gasp at, for a variety of reasons, in the same way that we gasp at. I think half of the gasping will be justified, and the other half will just be because words change over time. Like the word queer, for example, for me, has drastically changed 3 different times in my lifetime. And this is just for me. I can only evaluate the linguistics of my pocket. But when I was a kid, queer just meant weird. That's all it meant. And even the word gay and queer has completely changed multiple times in my lifetime to me, not just to society, but the way that the word feels to me has completely changed. The word queer when I was a kid meant weird. Then it started to be used euphemistically and hurtfully towards gay people, mainly gay men is what I remember it being used. Now it's used basically for anyone that's outside of the heteronormative expectation or outside of the heteronormative identity, right? Another word that has changed over time is the word gay. When I was a kid, it meant happy. The word gay was used in songs and in life. People would say, "Oh my God, he looks so gay." It didn't have any negative kinds, it was kind of a flavor of happy. It was like you were particularly happy and carefree. That's what it meant, at least in my linguistic circle. Then it became used as someone who was gay, homosexual. And while it continued to be used that way, it started to be bastardized by a-holes who would use it as a term for something that was stupid or that was below you or something. Oh my God, that's so gay, right? And then we changed and we no longer use it that way. I mean, there was a time, a good 20 years there, where a lot of people, regardless of how old you were, I mean, mainly it was younger people, but it could be anyone of any age, that they would regularly use the term, "Oh my God, that's so gay." There's probably some people of you listening right now who use that term, that phrase, when you were younger, and everyone in your social circle did the same. So anyway, yeah, Wax Asylum. You say that there's a salon by your house called Wax Asylum. Yeah. Why do you need to call it Wax Asylum? Especially that one. I mean, that one's pretty bad. There's really no way around what you're trying to get at there. And what are you trying to get at? Like, oh my God, it's just so crazy. What are you getting at? It's just, yeah, Wax Asylum. Come on. But really, whenever there are conversations around these words, the solution is not only to attack these words and the people who use them. The solution is to break down the stigmatization and to invite these groups of people into the public discourse, you know, people who binge and purge, people who suffer from addiction, people who suffer from mental illness, people who have insomnia, to actually recognize them, to include them, to humanize them, to talk about them, to allocate tax dollars to help them. If we were to do that for 50 years, then when you used a term like this for one of your, you know, in one of your conversations or to name a store, then these groups won't be hurt by it. They won't see it as yet another example of how society is discounting them and ignoring them. If you give people enough dignity and services and a voice, then these little issues don't really bother them, right? And I say this because there is seemingly a trend lately, and maybe it's always been this way, that people who are trying to change the system, people who are trying to do good, will only do this. They will only go on Twitter and attack people for using the wrong language instead of really going after the underlying issue, which really depends on voting. We are a big product of the way our money is used by our government, and it is not set in stone. We could be spending our money in a variety of ways. If we're going to solve it, we have to change the system, and we have to appeal to the people who have their hands on the money. All right, I'm just yammering. Let's take a break. All right, we're back from the break. Patron Emma from Arizona, who is going to be a therapist soon, she says, "Hi, Kirk. Would you talk about emetophobia or fear of vomit on the podcast? I have this phobia and have noticed that it is extremely common, but rarely talked about. I have had emetophobia since the age of 8, which I developed from witnessing vomiting from my alcoholic parents. I am 20 years old now and in therapy, but I'm struggling to find a therapist who is experienced with this phobia. I've decided to do some exposure work as homework, but it's quite difficult. Emetophobia is very debilitating, and I've seen many others, mostly women, online express that they suffer from it too. My question is, have you had experience in treating emetophobia? And any tips for sufferers out there? End of email." Yeah, I don't know the gender breakdown. I suspect that it doesn't run by gender lines because phobias don't tend to, but I don't know. And yeah, it's a well-known phobia, and there are many phobias, obviously, and this is one of them. Basically, when people have a fear of vomiting, it can manifest as a form of agoraphobia because they will worry that, well, what if I'm out and about, or what if I'm in a, you know, at work and I have to give a speech in front of people, and suddenly I have to vomit, and I vomit in front of everybody. And there's a tremendous fear of that. That's usually the fear. I suppose sometimes people have the fear about, what if I harm myself by vomiting or something like that. So it's usually kind of like a social phobia in a sense. But yeah, it's a well-known phobia that a lot of people have. And it's horrific. Yeah, it can be debilitating and really horrible. I guess some, you know, maybe for you, Emma, your fear of vomiting could just happen when you're at home alone and you're not really worried about other people reacting to it. It's just like a fear of losing control of your body. That could be another part of the phobia. But you're saying any tips? Well, find someone that knows how to do exposure therapy, because that's really the only thing you can do. There's no other treatment for a phobia other than exposure therapy. That's the only way you can treat it. There's psychodynamic therapy isn't going to work. Humanistic therapy isn't going to work. The only thing that's going to work is exposure therapy. And typically it does work, but you have to do it right. And you have to be diligent about following through on all the steps. So I would just find a therapist that knows how to do exposure work. And it sounds like you're, I don't know. You say that you have a therapist, you've been struggling. You're in therapy, you're 20. But you're struggling to find a therapist who is experienced with this phobia. Is your therapist inexperienced? But you also say you're doing exposure work as homework. It's possible that your therapist doesn't know the full extent of exposure and is just randomly assigning you to do exposure techniques or things at home, but doesn't know that you have to be very diligent about following through with that. You know, I've done exposure therapy with clients in which I have worked with them from afar, meaning that I would talk with them in session and then they would go home and do the exposure at home because it just wasn't possible for me to do it in session. And in those situations, I know that I really have to make sure that the client is doing it, that they're keeping really detailed logs of it while they're at home, that they, and they probably need to do it every day. And we need to talk about it pretty extensively. They might even record their thoughts as they're going through the exposures, and we play back the tape when in session, that kind of thing. So it sounds like maybe your therapist knows a little bit about it, but doesn't know the full extent of how much attention is needed for this sort of therapy. So yeah, I would just find someone that understands it. Now, I will say that you can, you're going to be a therapist soon. So I have had phobias myself, and I have run myself. No, I've never gone to a therapist for exposure therapy that I can think of, but I've suffered from a lot of phobias, and I know what exposure therapy is. And so I use it on myself. It's not easy. It's not all fun and games, but if you dedicate yourself, it's kind of like working out where, and working out in a way that you hate doing, right? Like think of the thing you hate worst in the workout regimen, you know, whether it's like a particular weight thing or sprinting or I don't know. There's probably something in your workout regimen that you just loathe. You just hate that one thing. Well, that's what this is like. It just doesn't, you don't want to do it, but you got to do it because it's the only thing that works. So I did that to myself, and it was sort of off and on, but it works. Habituation usually works. So, yeah. All right. This next email is from an anonymous patron. She writes, "What advice would you give a couple dealing with a version of Madonna whore complex? I've been with my husband for 14 years altogether, and throughout our relationship, our main issue has been with sexual intimacy. We met in our mid-20s, and I was his first long-term relationship and his first sexual relationship. I really liked at first that I felt safe and that he liked me for me and not just for my body. However, throughout the years, I realized he rarely initiated sex. We had sex about once a week, and I finally decided to see if he would initiate. And so we went 6 weeks without having sex. Now I know self-esteem comes from within. However, feeling the lack of desire from him really took a toll on my self-esteem, and I lashed out at him. I asked if he even noticed we hadn't had sex and why he hadn't initiated it. He said he noticed he would just get inside his head and just not do it. I asked if he was attracted to me at all, and he said he was, but he had a hard time expressing it." So just chime in here. So at the beginning of this email, you asked about Madonna whore complex, and maybe you'll get into it later in this email, but I'm not hearing anything about Madonna whore complex, that your husband cannot, the Madonna whore complex is basically, generally speaking, a complex or a belief system, a schema that is developed in traditional gender role societies that teach to men and heterosexual boys that a good woman is a woman that you want to marry, but good women are also not into sex. And that if a woman is into sex, then she's fun to have sex with, but she's not a respectable, good human being, and thus you shouldn't marry her. And so there's all these associations with, like, if you're into sex, then you're a whore, and if you're not, then you're respectable, you know, that whole ridiculousness. But I'm not hearing you say anything about that about your husband. It sounds like your husband just has who knows what's going on with him. He could be a wide variety of things. He could be asexual. He could be demisexual. He could be someone who just isn't that into sex or doesn't want to initiate. He could also be someone who has been traumatized by sexuality or sexual things in his life and has a hard time expressing it and hasn't recovered from it. It's also possible he has a hard time expressing himself at all. He has a hard time expressing he wants anything, let alone sex. It's also possible that he's depressed or that he's taking a medication that is suppressing his libido. You know, there's just a lot of reasons why this could be. It could be that your relationship is really stressful. It could be that the two of you have a lot of conflict, or he feels attacked by you or too pressured to have sex. You know, there's a lot of different reasons as to why you would have this libido disparity, but it's pretty common in couples to not have the exact same libido over time. It's just a very common thing. We don't talk about this in society very often. I think we just have this notion like, well, you know, good couples, they have the exact same libido and they do it frequently and everything works out. I don't think I've ever met a couple, even the really good ones out there, who have both members have the exact same libido over time, you know? In fact, a lot of times it can be pretty different. You know, one person wants it once a week, the other person wants it once a month, or one person wants it every day and the other person wants it once every 3 weeks or something. You know, it can be really different. And how do you navigate that? That's the thing. And you have to figure out a way to navigate it. And it can be complicated, but it needs to be done that way. And often what happens is the person who wants to have sex more is left out on the lurch. You know, they're the ones that feel bad about themselves and rejected. Occasionally, if that pursuer, that high libido member of the couple, imposes themselves, then of course the low libido person feels pressured and obligated, and they end up hating sex because it's a chore, right? So it's how we navigate these waters, not that we try to get rid of that difference, because it's virtually impossible to get rid of it. Sometimes you can change things a little bit, you know, like if your husband does have traumas and he does recover from them, then his libido might return and his libido might coincide with yours somehow. But anyway, yeah, I'm not hearing any Madonna whore issues going on here. I urged him to see a therapist at the time. He did go see someone, and I went to one session when the therapist invited me. I talked about the issue of sexuality in our relationship, and the therapist referred to an episode of Sex and the City in which a similar thing happens, and she laughed at the similarities. I laughed awkwardly as well, to be polite, but considering my boyfriend at the time has so much shame about sex, it did not make things better for him. Her advice was not to touch at all as long as possible, and hopefully that would increase the desire for touch and sex. Just chime in here. Yikes. Now, I can never know if y'all, when you email in, are describing the therapy session accurately. The therapist isn't here to defend themselves, but if this is somewhat close to the truth, then my God. if it all depends on a lot of, like, did you bring up the issue in a way that was that fully emphasized what you're trying to get across? You know, if you just casually brought up the libido difference issue, that'd be one thing. But if you brought it up in a very pointed way, like, it's a big deal to me that we have more sex. Now, it's also possible that your husband's therapist assessed the situation and kind of deemed you as someone who is overly pressuring in a variety of ways and is not taking your wishes seriously because they don't think that it's fair for you to want more of things that your husband doesn't necessarily want. You know, I don't know. There's just a lot of unknowns here. But if it is the way they describe it, and you bring it up, and there's no kind of pressuring there or any kind of coercion there going on, then your therapist saying that what should happen is that you should just not touch. The two of you should not touch as long as possible, and hopefully that will increase the desire for touch and sex. Well, let me talk about that. So in addressing sexuality in a couple, that particular intervention is part of one's repertoire. I've used a version of that in the past, but I don't use it in isolation, and it certainly isn't the first thing that I go to. But when we're trying to reinvigorate sexuality in a couple, or we're trying to make people feel comfortable enough, or I don't know, there's just a variety of different things that one would work on to try to improve the situation, I will throw a lot of things at the wall, and we will experiment with a lot of different things. And I might find myself experimenting with this. It's just like, how about we just take a break for a month? I don't know, though. This would be way down the line in priority, because to have this intervention risks, you know, permanently shutting down the physical affection within a couple. Now, if I felt like someone was being pursued way too much, so yeah, I could see myself doing that. If I felt like there was a very toxic pursuer-distancer relationship, and I felt like the pursuer was just obsessed with trying to get sex and trying to get contact, and it's like all they could think about all the time, and in addition to a variety of other things that I might try, I might say, how about we just go cold turkey for a month, and
hope, and in my head, I'm hoping that the pursuer will figure out a way to self-regulate without having to constantly turn to sexual contact or sexual conversations or something as a way of soothing whatever sort of itch they're trying to itch. But again, I can't see myself doing that very often, and it would be in a very, very large context. And I certainly wouldn't recommend it to someone that I just met for the very first time. But anyway, it sounds like the therapist didn't really know what they were doing or didn't take it seriously or something. But going on here, let's just say, considering he did not grow up with a lot of touch, this did not help at all, and he stopped seeing that therapist. At times, things would improve sexually between us, but then they would go back to how it was. Yeah, just chiming in here. That's pretty common when couples are trying to work with this. It's like there will be conversations, and the low libido person will dedicate themselves to initiating more or something for a time, but then you slide back into old behaviors. Going on. What also has bothered me is that I've seen him observe other women with a look of lust. It's not often, but it has happened a handful of times in our relationship. However, he never looks at me that way, even when I dress up. I do believe he loves me, he treats me well, and I don't believe he would ever cheat on me, but it's hard to be in a relationship where you don't feel desired. Just chiming in here. Yeah. That's where the Madonna whore idea comes from. You believe, I don't know, do you have a confirmation that he's looking at these other women with lust? Also, you would have to know more about that to know that he was suffering from Madonna whore. So, I don't know. It could be an extrapolation on something. But I wouldn't focus on Madonna whore. I would just focus on the fact that you would like to have more sex more often, and you want to enter into a conversation with him about it. I recommend seeing a couple therapists that specializes in this, by the way. So there's that. And it's hard to navigate this on your own. But you're completely fine to, one, want to have more sex. You're not entitled to get it, but you're entitled to want it. You are completely fine in correlating your self-esteem to feeling as though he is sexually attracted to you. That's a complicated issue, but there's nothing inherently wrong with that. You know, it's similar to depending on your partner for paying attention to you to make you feel good about yourself. You know, there's nothing wrong with associating your self-esteem to him being sexually attracted to you. I don't know, but there's a possibility that regardless of what you do, his libido is just the way that it is. And it's not some sort of Madonna whore thing. It's not some sort of trauma thing. It's not something that's changeable within him. He just doesn't like having sex that often, or doesn't think about it, or doesn't value it as much as you do, or something like that. And so in those situations, sometimes you just have to make a choice. Is it a deal breaker or not? And if it's not, then you have to figure out ways of dealing with it. And there are a lot of assumptions that will cause a lot of suffering if you don't change. For example, associating your self-esteem to him lusting after you. You know, that's natural to feel that way, but it's also potentially changeable, right? So I would absolutely find a couple of therapists that focuses on this and open up all the doors that are needed to face these kinds of things. Your husband would have to be up for it, though. All right, let's take a break. We get back a few more emails. All right, we're back from the break. Let's do an OPP. These people became patrons all the way back in 2020 and have stayed patrons ever since then. We have Lena from New York. We got Sky from Alberta, Edmonton. We have B from Everett, Washington, up there north of Seattle. Patrick from Garden City, New York. Samantha from Georgetown, Texas. Batlina from Great Britain, Glasgow. Amanda from Kamloops, British Columbia. I've been there. We have Marty from Kansas City, Missouri. We have Selena from Kent, Washington, where I lived when I was first born. Paulius from Latvia. Mimi from Australia. Rebecca from London. Declan from London. Charles from Louisville, Kentucky. Nolan from Michigan. Isabel from Miami, Florida. Michelle from Middletown, Connecticut. It's probably pronounced Milton, I'm guessing. And B from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Thank you for being a patron through thick and thin over the last few years. Truly, you warm my heart and pay some of my bills. All right, the next email is from anonymous patron. They write, "What is the utility of diagnosing a personality disorder before the brain is fully developed? Research shows the brain is not fully developed until age 25. Why is it useful to diagnose a personality disorder when someone's issue could just be an underdeveloped prefrontal cortex, thus general immaturity?" End of email. Well, it's a complicated a question. On average, our brain is considered to be not quote-unquote fully developed. I mean, what do we mean by not fully developed? Because the brain continues to quote-unquote develop, meaning change over time, for our entire life. So our brain doesn't just hit this magical cutoff point at the age 25. Plus, it's different for different people. Some people will hit the markers of what we call a fully developed prefrontal cortex earlier, and some people later. Some people never reach that point. So it's not this, it's not like, you know, turning 18 and suddenly you can vote, right? It's a squishy idea. That's one. Two, yeah, I mean, the premise has always been understood by clinicians and experts in this area that we should be careful about diagnosing people with personality disorder prior to them fully developing as into their adult personality. And traditionally, we've used the cutoff point of 18 because a lot of the brain has developed by 18, or at least a lot of the personality has developed by that age. But absolutely, you could have someone that was 21 and exhibiting the symptoms of a personality disorder, but as their brain develops and as they acquire more experiences, by the time they're 27, without any treatment, they just age out of their personality disorder. Yeah, absolutely. But it's not as if it's this high crime if you do that. And usually what we will do, and I've diagnosed kids, you know, teenagers with personality disorders, I don't put it in their file, but I conceptualize them that way. I mean, sometimes I'll put it in their file, but I'll conceptualize a 16-year-old, for example, as having burgeoning borderline, for example, or burgeoning narcissism or burgeoning avoidant or something. And I don't put it in the record. I might talk with other clinicians along those lines, as long as I understand they know what I'm talking about, meaning that I am saying they exhibit the precursors of the adult form of the personality disorder, but I can't know if they are heading in that direction because they're still developing neurologically or personality-wise. So that's a very short, simplistic answer to a very complicated question. All right, this next email is from patron Matt from Minneapolis. He writes, "What are your thoughts on Theodore Millon as a contributor to the conversations and subtypes of personality disorders? I was thinking about buying some of his books." End of email. Yeah, I have great respect for Theodore Millon. His research and his conceptualization of personality disorders is very much in alignment with the way I conceptualize it. I'm guessing that a fair amount of the beginning of my understanding of personality disorders came from him. And a lot of the subtypes I absolutely appreciate as well. Theodore Millon had a very nuanced, very deep understanding of personality disorders. He researched a lot. He conducted a lot of research. He also oversaw a lot of research and maybe continues to do so. Is he still around? Is he still alive? Let me Google it. Theodore Millon. No, he died in 2014. Anyway, so he did a lot of work, and I mean, he's just a huge figure to me when it comes to personality disorders. Whenever I do a deep dive, there's a pretty good chance that at least part of my prep for the episode will be to read his writings. So yeah, absolutely. All right, this next email is from patron Ms. Jones. She says, "How can my partner and I go about treating our daughter's suspected antisocial personality disorder when it starts affecting the rest of our family? My stepdaughter is suspected to have antisocial personality disorder. She has no regard for others or the results of her actions. She blames her father for things that have never happened. I know because I have been there as a stay-at-home mom. It is beginning to affect my son, who is 3 years old. What can I do?" End of email. Well, let's see. How can my partner and I go about treating our daughter suspected antisocial personality disorder? Well, you need a therapist that specializes in it. I don't recommend you treating your daughter at all. But when it comes to parenting, I recommend you parent. Of course, you are parenting this daughter. Yeah, let's just assume that you're right, that the daughter does have antisocial and will always, or at least have the tendencies the rest of her life. It tends to work out that way. It's hard to know, but let's just assume that for now that that's true. And what do you do? It's hard. Again, I would find a specialist. I would find a family therapist that specializes in this. It could be hard to find one that specializes in it. There's no good answer. There's no way to get rid of someone's innate lack of empathy. There are only ways that you can work around it. And there are only ways that you can manage to reduce the harm. That's all you can do. It's just coping with it usually. And I've worked with families like this, and it's hit or miss, because with a teenager, they're generally not interested in therapy anyway, and then some with antisocial is particularly not interested. But I've treated young psychopaths, young antisocial individuals, and had some headway with them, where I teach them that it's within their best interest to not harm other people and to, at least as much as they can, respect other people's lives and wishes for about them, because it ends up going better for the individual, you know. But that's hard to do, and it's frustrating. The other thing is, yeah, absolutely, it's affecting your son who's 3 years old. So I would just do a lot to try to protect your son. That might mean separating the kids. It might mean, I don't know. But the thing you don't want to do is to focus all your attention on the antisocial kid while your 3-year-old son is neglected overall, or even is abused by the older sister, and you're not there to help. So what I tell parents is that, and your kid's 3, so it probably isn't manifesting this way, but the other kids in families like this will learn that it's best if they just put their head down and shut up, because they don't want to add to the stress of the parents. But the sacrifice that the kids make for themselves is that they stop alerting their parents to their troubles and their pain. And the parents are already kind of ignoring the kid anyway, because they're distracted by the troubled kid. But what ends up happening is the kid will just have a whole childhood where they're being ignored and discounted and made to feel like they need to constantly please other people, you know, parentified kids, essentially. So you have to put extra effort into making sure that the kid actually continues to signal to you. I'm guessing that the kid's 3, so there's a lot of time to make sure that that pattern doesn't set in. The other possibility is your daughter doesn't actually have antisocial, and you're just interpreting it that way, because it's a hard thing to diagnose. My dog's barking. It's a hard thing to diagnose. It's pretty complicated. So again, I would seek out professional help. All right, this next email is from an anonymous patron. She writes, "Can someone be both dependent and codependent? I ask because my mom can be a lot like Tanya from 90 Day Fiancé, very in-your-face and suffocating, like a codependent person, but also exhibits a lot of chaotic behavior that forces people to take care of her and will become sort of babyish around men especially. Why would someone need to do this? Thanks for reading." End of email. Yeah, absolutely. It's counterintuitive, because often codependent and dependent people fit very well together. The overfunctioning codependent fits very, very well with an underfunctioning dependent person, right? In fact, in the most classic examples, that's always the configuration, is between a codependent and dependent individual. So it's counterintuitive that one person could be both overfunctioning and underfunctioning, but it does happen. And Tanya from 90 Day Fiancé, who are familiar with the show, at least on the very limited data presented on the show, might be a good candidate of that, in that Tanya with her husband was seemingly over-functioning and codependent, in that she would find someone that had a problem. Sinjin seemed to have a problem with alcohol since the very beginning, and also a problem with kind of general irresponsibility. And Tanya would talk down to him, would micromanage him, would criticize him, would try to change him, and there would be this dynamic of her nagging him all the time, right? And it ended up causing a divorce in their relationship. At the same time, we exhibit on the show that Tanya is fairly dependent on her mom. It's hard to know, but from the details on the show, she was in her 30s, I think, or late 20s, and she was getting a degree in something that wasn't necessarily likely to make any money, and she was still living at home with her mom. She was living like in an outbuilding with her mom. Now, there's nothing wrong with living at home with your mom, but she would criticize her husband, Sinjin, for not having money and not having his own house and stuff when she didn't herself. So I don't know if all those details are correct, but it did seem to have that kind of thing. But the way you describe that your mom would do that, it's like a lot of in your face and suffocating behavior, that of an overfunctioning codependent person. And there are many different types of codependent people. There are that type, which is the controlling type, but there's also other types who aren't controlling. But also, your mom was chaotic and forces people to take care of her at the same time. Yeah, absolutely. Seems counterintuitive, but that can't exist in the same person. And you ask why that is. Well, the way that I would frame it is that they basically have the foundational schemas of both. That the codependent schema is my only worth is that I am taking care of someone with a problem. That's the only way I can get love and attention. Also, I have another schema that other people are basically idiots and that I'm the only smart one in the room, because that was true for me when I was growing up. So you have that schema that's driving the codependent behavior, being in your face and suffocating. But then this individual also had experiences that made them feel like they were basically incompetent, maybe in some select areas. You know, maybe they're basically incompetent in matters of emotion or matters of paying the bills. But with their codependency, they believe they're superior to others in other areas. So there's that. The other thing is that typically codependent and dependent people grew up in configurations that involved one or both of those personalities being exhibited at the family. If they're a dependent person, they might have had a codependent parent. And so they might have internalized a lot of those qualities from the parent. And they see relationships through that lens. And you'll see this sometimes, actually, that if I've treated families like this and couples where I'll have a codependent and a dependent, and say I get the dependent person to stop having the schema, or I help them to heal from those schema notions that they're basically incompetent and they can never do anything on their own without the help of the person they're depending on. And so we heal that, and the dependent person changes more to a non-dependent person, meaning someone who has a good balance of dependency, and they start to draw boundaries with a codependent person. Well, sometimes you'll see a complete flip-flop, and the codependent person, who had a lifetime of basically always being codependent, now flip-flops to being the dependent person, because the codependent person sees relationships through that lens. There always has to be a codependent, controlling person who's taking care of someone who has a problem, and there's someone else who was under-functioning, and they always have a problem, and they refuse to change. And so if they're in a relationship and they're like, wow, codependency isn't working anymore, I better change. Well, the other thing I have available to me is dependency. The other thing is that when you give people a lot of relational traumas and they emerge out of childhood with codependent schemas and personality traits, they have a lot of unmet needs, right? So you'll find this with parentified codependent people. When you finally give them a space to not be parentified and not be codependent, sometimes they will revert and regress to the time when they were being neglected. Maybe it was the age of 5 or 7 years old. They will revert back there and they'll be like, okay, I don't need to constantly be monitoring a problematic individual's behavior. That's not my job anymore. Or the system isn't letting me do it. Okay, fine. Well, what I need to do, you know, the next thing on my priority list is I need to actually get my needs met that were denied to me when I was 5 years old. So let's go back there. And it's a mistake that the person makes that's like, well, I have to act like I'm 5. I have to be 7 years old in order to get the attention that I deserve. And they don't need to do that. They don't need to throw their life away in order to get people to take care of them. But of course, that's how they see it. You know, they see the world through people who are competent and in control and superior and the under functioner. So sometimes you'll see that. All right, this next email is from anonymous annual patron. They say, I could not have resonated with your obsessive compulsive personality disorder deep dive more. I am very concerned with how I appear to other people, needing work emails, for example, to be perfect and flaw free. Just jam me in here. Yeah, I received a number of emails from people saying that they, you know, resonate with the label and the conceptualization of OCPD. And many of the people would end the email saying that they had rewritten the email like 10 times before sending it to me as a further example of their OCPD. So, you know, you're in good company. going on here. I believe this comes from when I was a younger. I believe this comes from when I was younger and never receiving any praise and only receiving negative attention when I was imperfect. Like when I got a 98% on a test, but was asked by my parents why I didn't get 100%. Just chiming in here. Yeah, absolutely. It undoubtedly comes from when you were a child and you were pressured to be perfect and you were withheld attunement in all likelihood. Going on. My OCPD makes me very good at my job, but it makes me very poor at receiving criticism, in which I get very, very defensive. It also comes out when I plan trips. I become insufferable to my travel companions when we don't get to all the items in my plans. I will get very irritable and lash out when we can't follow my plans. I can recognize this behavior is irrational, but also cannot help the urge that we have to follow my travel plans exactly. Any comments on how to become more flexible? End of email. Well, the short answer is therapy with someone that knows what they're doing, because it takes a lot of self-awareness and schema work and corrective experiences, emotional regulation to change what you have. You know, there are two pillars to therapy, in my opinion. One is self-awareness, which you have. You already see. Now, if you wanted to, you could increase your self-awareness in the moment to be able to incorporate other options. Like the next time you have one of these fits of OCPD, you can really acknowledge that's what you're going through and also just verbalize it. You could go through a phase where whenever you're having these moments of getting defensive or getting really rigid, where you recognize that you're having your OCPD getting triggered, and you tell everyone, and you've already told everyone about your OCPD beforehand, so they know it's coming, and you tell them, look, everyone, my OCPD and my flaw shame is getting triggered right now, and I'm about to lose my shit unless everyone does the travel plan exactly. I know that's not okay with you, and I know that that's not fair to you, but I need everyone to accommodate me or else I'm going to have a fucking meltdown. Now, your travel companions or your workmates might not go along with it, but you're giving them a chance to go along with it and you're verbalizing it. You know, so maybe that's a phase of going down the road. But the two pillars are self-awareness and, oh, the other thing about self-awareness is that you can have self-awareness after the fact, but you can maybe try to work on having a lot more self-awareness during the fact. Like really knowing, oh, this is what's happening to me right now, and then have other ways of coping with it. For example, for me, the more I became aware of this for myself is if I really focus on the distortion, at, like if I was in your shoes, I don't have this. I would get defensive sometimes for sure. I'm trying to think of a time when I would have been. Well, it's when I would get negative criticism. Like, so recently, I was in Walmart and I was just kind of walking around perusing different things, seeing if there was anything that I needed. And I saw this sweatshirt and it said self-care on the front. And I thought, that's kind of funny that there'd be this, because most of the clothes at Walmart are very generic looking. They're just sort of like nondescript clothing, just sort of your standard shirts and your standard sweatpants and stuff. Then out of the blue, there's this bright sweatshirt that says self-care. And I thought, oh, I'll take a picture of that and put it on Instagram. So I took a picture of it, put it on Instagram, and I put up a thumbs up and I said, thumbs up Walmart. And I don't know. I just thought it was just this little nice thing that I saw in my day. I wasn't thinking anything beyond that. Well, one person just went completely off on me in the comments on Instagram saying I was a horrible, I don't know what they said, but they made it seem like I was a horrible human being because I was supporting exploitative labor practices by Walmart. And I don't know, anyone I think who would know me would know that I wouldn't do that. And also, like, I just saw a sweatshirt and I thought it was nice and I thought it was a good message to put out into the world. And by me saying thumbs up Walmart, I'm not saying Walmart is a good place. And maybe I stepped into some weird political crossfire of some kind. I don't know. I don't read all the news stories, so who knows? But the person, you know, it was a lot of all caps and a lot of this and that. And it hurt my feelings, and it made me start to wonder if I should shut down my Instagram, honestly, because I'm just like, fuck, you know, here we go again. Like, it just, it's like, I don't need to share shit on Instagram. I don't give a fuck. But people like to see behind the scenes stuff, and I like to share it if people want to see it. You know, I'll be with the dogs and I'll take a little picture and I'll post it, you know. I don't get paid to do it. It just is a fun thing to share. And people, you know, podcasts that I listen to, I'll look at their Instagrams and just kind of like to see behind the scenes stuff. It's just a little pleasant thing in a someone's day. And to just have it just be such a toxic environment occasionally, which doesn't usually happen on Instagram, to be honest. But anyway, so that happened, and I started to descend into being upset. You know, all the normal phrases start running around in my head and the tension in my body. Well, what I did was I said, okay, let's look at it. You know, self-awareness. Let's really stare at what's happening to you right now. And I told myself, well, a portion of this is rational. It's normal to be upset at someone who is basically accusing you of being pro-exploitation of labor, which I have never been and never will be. I think I've demonstrated myself to be pro-labor and for the oppressed. You know, I speak up for the oppressed all the time. Not as much as other people, but I do a lot, I think. For someone to accuse you of that is pretty egregious and hurtful. And you know, maybe the Walmart thing was tone deaf. I don't know. But if it was a mistake, it was an innocent mistake. Anyway, now, did I know that Walmart is exploitative? Yes. But that's not the entirety of my associations with Walmart. You know, it's sort of like, does the American government occasionally invade other countries and kill people and commit genocide? Yeah, but that's not my only association with the American government. You know, I celebrate the 4th of July because I like the good parts of the United States. I like the good parts of American culture. I like the good parts of American history. I choose to identify with the people who have risen above it and risen above the oppression and fought together as a collective. Martin Luther King, the civil rights movement, the Civil War for that matter. You know, I'm proud of the actions taken by many Americans, and I'm ashamed of a lot of the actions by Americans as well. But anyway, so when I look at Walmart, I don't only see one thing about it, you know? And the same allegation or criticism you have of Walmart, you could attribute it to all sorts of businesses, you know? Apple probably has all sorts of problems with their labor practices overseas. And so it's a problem and let's attack it. But I just post a fucking picture that had a sweatshirt that said self-care. It's because I wanted to put that out into the world. And it just happened to be a sweatshirt at Walmart. I mean, I don't know. Anyway, point is I had to have that like a little conversation in my head. And I probably yammered at my wife a little bit about it too. And then I have to wonder, okay, I'm still feeling more distressed than I think I should. So it must have to do with my floss shame. So what's going on there? And I look at it and I say, okay, there's an imperfect thing that has happened. You know, the way my perfectionism manifests, at least one of the ways, is I need my messaging on my public platform to be perfect. I need everything that I put out there in terms of content to be absolutely perfect. Now, I'm sure a lot of you are just like, well, Kirk, none of it is perfect. You've never put out perfect. What is a perfect podcast anyway? Yeah, but you focus on very odd things when you have OCPD. You focus on very minor things as you're trying to get a toehold on, is that the word? You're trying to get some kind of grasp onto the ledge of perfectionism, and you will identify anything that will give you that possibility. And one of the things that I hold on to is that there will be not a single human being that consumes my various different content who will interpret it in a way that is wrong or counter to the way I meant it. You know, the way I meant the post was this frivolous little thing, but it was this reminder to everyone out there to take care of themselves. That's all I meant it to be. And I just thought it was funny that it happened to be at Walmart because it just seems counter to what I think about Walmart. But anyway, that was what my messaging was, but someone interpreted it, at least seemingly interpreted it, or at least I interpreted their interpretation as a message of being pro-exploitation of labor. And that is something that I depend on not happening to be an indication that I don't have a flaw. So when I phrase it that way in my head, I'm like, but that's impossible. One, you're always going to be misinterpreted. That's just going to happen, especially when literally millions of people are consuming your content on a yearly basis. So that's going to happen. And two, if people are going to misinterpret things, that's kind of on them. You know, if 99% of people interpret it a certain way and one person interprets it this different way, then there's something obviously really different about that person. Now, I didn't take a poll on how people reacted to that Instagram post. You know, maybe it was a greater percentage that interpreted it in the way that this person was. I don't know. But bottom line, I was holding on to this notion that I cannot have any kind of flaw. Because what if I, for myself, were to accept, radically accept, that I have flaws and that I am going to be misinterpreted, even when I'm meaning well, and that's going to hurt some feelings and some people are going to get upset and they're going to attack me because of that? What does that really mean? Does that mean that my life is going to end tomorrow? Because that's how it feels. And I'd say, well, no, my life isn't going to end tomorrow. Does that mean I'm going to lose my career tomorrow? And the answer is no. No one's going to cancel me because of that. At least I don't think they would. And I'm sure if there was some movement to cancel me, I'm pretty sure that the people who know me would stick with me or at least defend me or something. Anyway, so it's just not a rational worry, right? It's not a rational association. It's not rational to associate imperfection along those lines with a complete breakdown of my life. I mean, to take it even further, and this is what I would do if I was talking to a client. Well, let's say that it does make the worst thing happen. Let's say that you, because of that comment, that is a harbinger of you being canceled. What does that mean? Okay, I get canceled from the internet and everyone boycotts me and I no longer have a podcast. I have no more patrons. No one watches me on YouTube and I can no longer make money doing this podcast. Well, then what? Well, then I'd just go back to the university and be a therapist. I'd just go back to my original career, which I loved. So is that the end of the world? No, it's not what I want. I love this podcast and I want to do it, but you know, shit happens. And if the world decides that they don't want me anymore, then the world decides they don't want me anymore. So it's not the end of the world. I'll still have my wife. I'll still have my family. I'll still have my relative health. I'll still have my dogs. I'll still have my fun things that I do in life, my friends, Bob. I'll still have the general meaning of my life being met by trying to make the world a better place. And so no, it's not the end of the world. No one's going to die. So that's another thing to kind of focus on. It's like, okay, this one person seemingly is really, really angry at me on Instagram and it's ruining my week. And why? Now, when I do that, does it take away my OCPD? No. I'm not, it just means that it mitigates the pain some, you know. So that's what self-awareness means. It's not just being aware of it. It's a process of full self-awareness and an active process. Okay, so that's number one, pillar of self-awareness. Number two is corrective experiences. So anonymous annual patron, therapy with corrective experiences, which I've had, by the way, to correct for your flaw shame is very, very important. All right, well, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle, in which I answer those questions and remind everyone that I have a thin skin. And everyone out there, have some self-care. Thumbs up to that and take care of yourself because you deserve it. You really, really do.